This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hey everyone, Boomer Esiason here. The NFL draft is behind us and your favorite team is now gearing up for week number one. The free Odyssey app puts you right in the middle of the pro football conversation with the biggest sports radio stations from across the country. The local voices who know your team the best, giving you their unfiltered takes on the current state of your squad. It's always football season right here on the free Odyssey app.
A great Chicagoan, a great TV, and a great movie actor, our friend Joe Mantegna, nice enough to take some time from California on a Saturday morning to join us on Inside the Clubhouse. Joe, Matt, and Bruce with you. Thank you for taking some time out. Good morning to you.
Hey, good morning to you guys.
Yeah, we appreciate it very much. You know, I was telling Matt and the audience earlier, you and I were supposed to be at a fundraiser last week in Mesa for raising money for the Special Olympics. And it was supposed to be at the Sheraton Hotel in Mesa. It was going to be a great night for Chicago Cubs. And obviously that was called off. And now we're having you here a week later to talk a little bit about some of the things in your career and some of the things going on. Let's go all the way back. Your career started in the late 60s in TV, but mostly in plays and writing and co-writing the Bleacher Bums. Where did the impetus come from for Bleacher Bums for you personally as a Chicagoan?
Well, what it was I've been a member of the Organic Theater in Chicago at that time for about 4 or 5 years, where we would do and our plays would come from, you know, different places. We would do take novels and turn them into plays. And our director, our esteemed director, actually just passed away last week, Stuart Gordon, would come up with an idea and we'd work on it. And whatever. They came from different sources. Sometimes they were existing plays. But this was the summer of 77, and we had done our season that year, and we'd basically run out of all of our grant money. We had about $200 left, and we had a choice to try to come up with a play that would cost less than $200, or basically take the summer off and wait till our grant money started to come in the fall. So we had a meeting in the theater, and I remember Stuart asked all of us, he said, look, if anybody has an idea for a play that costs less than $200, maybe we can do something. And I, being an avid Cub fan since I was, 5 years old at least, I'd go to the bleachers, the kind of money I was making, as an actor in Chicago. The bleachers is where you kind of wind up, because back then I think seats were about a buck and a quarter. I sat in this one section of the right center field bleachers where I just used to amaze me at what was going on there. In other words, I thought to myself, wow, this is as entertaining as the game. Because you got to remember, the Cubs in the late 60s were might have been entertaining, but not so entertaining that it was going to, if you were a huge baseball fan, was going to light your fire every game. So what was going on in the stands was, I found to be quite amusing and interesting and kind of reflective of what being a baseball fan was all about. So I raised my hand and says, I have this idea for a play. I said, if you all will join me to my section in the bleachers in Wrigley Field, the Cubs were doing a homestand at that time. I said, you tell me if you agree that there's a play there. So we all tramped down to Wrigley Field, and we spent the next 3 days, sitting in my section of the bleachers there. And when we came back from the field trip, we all agreed that, without question, this was the makings of perhaps good theater. And luckily, we'd all been together for many years. Dennis Franz was a member of that company. It was just a beautiful kind of combination of people. And with the guidance of Stuart Gordon and another good friend of his, Dennis Paoli, who was also a writer he had known since they were kids together, we did a lot of hours of improvs putting together this scenario of creating this, basically creating a baseball game, a nine-inning baseball game that would deal, you know, with the, you know, starting with the beginning of the game, go through the game, end with the game ending, sing the seventh inning stretch through the whole game, the Cubs-St. Louis game, but you, from the perspective of you looking at this section of the bleachers. So our audience sat actually in the center of the theater, and we sat up in the risers, which used to be the seats. That's why we were able to do it so cheaply, because we had no set. We sat up where the audience would usually sit in the theater. We took the seats out and sat up on the concrete risers. And for costumes, we all went to AmVets on Wednesday, which would have half price day, and we would just buy clothes like you'd wear to a baseball game. So the whole show probably cost less than $200, but it wound up, as it turned out, probably being one of the most successful plays Organic ever did. So it was just, you know, Cubs luck, you know, it all worked out, and it was just it's been a big thrill for me that to this day it's still being produced many places all over the world, especially at Summerstock.
What a great story, Joe, and so many things in there. I love the idea of professional research being 3 days in the bleachers. Nice work if you can get But it makes so much sense because baseball, really more than any other sport, it lends itself to literature, to poetry. There's so much music, and there's so much incredible. There's drama. Why do you think the game itself, is it the failure, the volume of failure that's in it? Is it the pacing of it, the constancy of a season? Why do you think the game lends itself to art better than other sports?
Well, I think a lot of that is true. I think one of the main reasons is that there's not a clock involved. There's no time limit on the games, in the sense that unless it gets too dark or it starts to rain or, you know, something unnatural happens to interrupt it. And so it's, in a way, it's like life that way. I mean, they've tried to put some sort of restrictions on it, you know, here and there. But at the end of the day, it does have its own pace, as does life. So you never quite know when are the times that it's going to get, you know, lag. When is it going to be exciting? When is it going to start? That was, in a way, that's what caused the play, in other words, to work, because you can kind of use the ebb and flow of the game to kind of do the drama of the play. I mean, there always has to be that little break in the action between innings, and, you know, during when they're changing a pitcher or something like that, or maybe one inning's going on for 20 minutes and another inning's going on for two minutes. So I think that's part of it. And, you know, it's the summertime. It's all of those things. It's the smell, it's the sound, it's the, like you say, the music. I don't know. It's very Americana, I guess, in many ways, too, what we think of it. It's very Norman Rockwell-esque, you know. I don't know. And I guess it's, you know, I just think back to being a kid and my dad taking me there, you know, when I was, like I say, under 5 years old, and looking out on that field and seeing how. I'll give you one thing that I think explains it well. There's one character in the play, Bleacher Bums, who's blind. And we based it on three of these guys who used to sit in the section, and all three of them were blind. But we combined them into one character named. The real guy's name was Craig, who to this day is one of the sportscasters at Wrigley Field.
Yes, sir.
And I see him whenever I go to Wrigley to this day, and we talk. But he would go with his two friends, and they were all blind, and they'd be there. One guy would have the radio, the other guy would have a cowbell, and the other guy would call the game. So we combined them into one character. So we did all this research about that. And in doing the research, we found out that this one guy, not one of the three, but another blind Cub fan, who had gone to all the games, and I heard this story from Jack Brickhouse because we interviewed him. He said this blind guy finally was able to get his vision fixed. They gave him a cornea transplant or whatever it was, and they fixed his vision. And then when he came to his first Cub game after the transplant, Brickhouse asked him, he said, "I want to ask you, what was it like seeing a baseball game for the first time? Because you've come to all these games, you're a huge fan, and you attend the games. What was it like to see it?" And he said, the guy said to me, he said, there were two things that struck him. He says, one was the color green, as to how green everything was. You know, that here was this expanse of this color. He says, but the other thing, which was even bigger, was that the men were all normal size. Because he says when you experience the game without sight and you're there in the ballpark and you're hearing the sounds and the roar of the crowds, you're imagining that the men out there playing the game are giants and that these huge human beings that are like 50 feet tall sliding around the bases and jumping. And he says, they're just normal sized people. And I thought, wow, that's in a way that's the fantasy we kind of create. As a child, in a way, for the game, in some way.
The great actor, writer, producer, and Chicagoan from Cicero, Illinois, Joe Mantegna, nice enough to continue to join us here on Inside the Clubhouse. Joe, you not only have one, but two streets named after you, one in Cicero, one in Chicago. How many people can say they have two streets in the Chicagoland area named after him? That means you must have done something right along the way.
I don't know. I guess so. At least I was very good with the public works department or something in those towns. No, I'm very proud of that. I mean, in the sense that I'm honored and flattered that, you know, anyone would think, you know, to name a street after me. But look, Chicago and Cicero both have obviously huge meaning in my life, and the fact that the two streets in particular, the one where the one sign is in Cicero is right in front of the high school, Morton East High School, at 25th and Austin there, and I spent 6 years in that building, and there's a lot of people when I say that, they go, 6 years? You took you 6 years to get through high school? And I was like, no, actually, I did the high school there for 4 years, but back then, Morton Junior College was also located in that same building. They have their own school now, but back then in the 60s, it was all in the same building. So I spent 6 years in that building. And then and in Chicago, it's in front of the River Shannon bar up on the near north side, this wonderful, wonderful bar. Up around on Armitage there, and when I was a student at the Goodman School of Drama, myself and two of my roommates from school, we all lived in an apartment above the bar, and so it has very fond memories for me in terms of, you know, my growing up and the years that I was learning to be an actor as a student at Morton and Cicero and at college, and then again at the Goodman. So those
when you talk
kind of book in my education,
Joe, when you talk to Chicagoans, do you come back to the Chicago accent? Are you at home being Chicagoan? Is it north? Is it south? Does it all come back to you when you speak to Chicagoans?
Oh, well, my wife is from Chicago too, so I mean, you know, there's no getting around it. And the other thing is, you know, Dennis Franz is still my dear friend, and a lot of times the dear late Dennis Farina was also a dear friend, and there were times when Dennis Franz and Dennis Farina and I would get together, and I'd say when the three of us get together with our accents, I would be not surprised if the Wrigley Building would suddenly appear, you know, just kind of manifest itself. Because we find ourselves pretty much kind of talking like you three guys over there, you know. And then when I hosted Saturday Night Live and they created that Dalberge skit, the very first one they created for me when I hosted the show, and it gave me a chance to really lean into the accent then, and not at the time not realizing that skit was then going to go on, and then my dear friend George Wendt was going to start doing, you know, fly in and do a lot of versions of it. And I wound up doing another one with him. And so, yeah, I think when I open my mouth, especially when I'm around Chicagoans, nobody mistakes me as being a guy from anywhere else. That's for sure.
It's quite a group of talented people you're around there. Joe Mantegna, Dennis Franz, Dennis Farina, obviously your collaborator, your great collaborator, David Mamet. And for people that don't know, you were a bass player in the Apocryphals, and you guys used to play gigs with this other band, The Missing Links. And The Missing Links go on to become Chicago, the band Chicago. And I know you've been friends with them and been close with them through the years. Did you know, as a bass player and as a musician, did you realize that these guys in the missing links, they're really, really good. They're differently good than you were and you guys were. Did you know it?
I learned to know it in a sense, because when we first met them, when they were the missing links, they were good. The main good thing about them is they were excellent musicians. They knew how to read music. They were just terrific musicians. But they weren't doing a lot of original stuff then. And in fact, when we first played with them, it was the State Fair in Louisville, Kentucky. And Bobby Sherman was on the act, and the Outsiders, and Cannibal, and the Headhunters. These were all kind of popular groups back in the 60s. And they would use the missing links as the guys who would back up the solo acts, because they were the only musicians there that could read music. I mean, all the rest of us would play by ear and we'd copy songs. We were a good cover band, the Apocryphals, and we did very well. We were very popular. But the missing links were kind of like, they were pretty straight. They were just kind of like, you know, they played their music, but they were mainly just really good musicians. Then what happened was, we were playing at the Cheetah in Chicago, the old Aragon Ballroom.
Oh, yeah.
Came to Cheetah back in the 60s. And we were playing there. They came to see us play. And when they came to see us that night, they said to us, we're changing the band. We're getting rid of the name The Missing Links. We're adding a keyboard player. We're adding a trumpet player. We're adding a trombone player. And we're going to expand the group to 7 guys. We're just going to write our own music, and we're going to call ourselves the Chicago Transit Authority. And we thought, oh, that's interesting. Wow, that's great. And I remember when they left the Cheetah that night, we all looked at each other and said, these guys are nuts. What are they doing? They're expanding from 4 members to 7. They're never going to make 10 cents. And for a while they didn't, because they were writing their own music. They would still go to the same clubs we played, and they wouldn't play cover songs that hit Pop 40. They would play their own stuff, and kids weren't hearing the stuff on the radio yet. And so they would go, we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that. And there was really more than one instance where we would get a call from the owners of the clubs saying, look, we're getting rid of this group, Chicago Transit Authority, and we're going to bring in, you guys come in and fill the rest of the weekend, you know. And we would do it, and it was like, oh, we felt bad for them. But then their first album came out. We didn't hear from them for a while. Their first album came out. And I remember I was a student at the Goodman, and I was still in the band at the time. That first album came out, and when I heard it, I thought to myself, okay, it's time for me to change careers. Because I knew that the Apocryphals, as good as we were as a cover band, we just never were going to be able to do that, you know. And that's when I really saw the true genius of that group. And we've been friends for over 50 years ever since. And a great band, still, you know, my favorite. If you look at episodes of Criminal Minds, you'll see it in my office. Anybody who looks closely, there's a signed album from the band Chicago that's behind my desk. And I also even did other TV shows I did would kind of work in a little bit of the band Chicago, as well as the Cubs, into my stuff on set. But yeah, no, great, great, great guys and a great, great rock and roll band.
Joe Mantegna with us for a few more minutes, gracious with his time. If you're willing to, he would like it, I would like it. Go to give.specialolympics.org to make a donation, something that's near and dear to Joe's heart as well as mine. And Joe, let's go to 1987. I'm not sure of this, but I'm pretty sure that you did a game when Harry Carey had a stroke. Did you do a game with Steve Stone? They had celebrity co-broadcasters with Steve at that time. Did you do one of those games?
Not that I can recall. I don't remember being up in the booth with Steve. I mean, I met Steve, but I don't think I did that. One game I did do, which is kind of a landmark game at Wrigley Field, I threw out the first pitch and sang the 7th inning stretch at the game that Kerry Wood struck out 20 Houston Astros and tied the major league record for strikeouts. And I'm sitting in my office right now, and I'm looking at the ball that he signed and dated, which arguably could be in Cooperstown, because it's the first pitch ball of the game, Kerry Wood, tied the major league record for strikeouts. I mean, I'll never forget that day. So that was pretty.
That memorable. Was in May 6, 98. Yep, that's something special.
Yeah, I'm looking at the ball right now, and he dated it, and that's exactly what it says.
Well, you're clearly the good luck charm. You're clearly the big factor on that day. You know, I got to say, Bruce, when you were going to 1987, I got excited because I'm in high school at the time, and the movie House of Games that David Mamet wrote and directed with you and Lindsey Crouse completely changed my appreciation for film, introduced me to Ricky Jay and the concept of a con, really, you know, and just like what a puzzle and what a great con that entire movie is. And I just had to mention how phenomenal I think that film was and how important it was at the time.
You know, they just had, just about a month ago, they had a film noir movie night in Santa Monica, and they showed that film. And Dave was there, Mamet spoke, I attended with one of my daughters, and it was the first time I'd seen the movie probably since the late 80s. So that was kind of fun. It's funny you bring that up because I hadn't thought about that movie in a long time, but that brought it very fresh in my mind. And yeah, it still kind of holds up. And I know in some places like France, they consider it, you know, it's every once in a while they'll release it in movie theaters. It had quite an impact, that film. Yeah.
Joe, we only have a couple more minutes left here. What is the impact of the coronavirus in Los Angeles? How are people dealing with it in your city?
Well, you know, it's the same here as I'm sure it's there and everywhere. It's just one of these things, you know. I read something, though, that gave me pause and made me think, you know, as we all go through this, is that certainly people of my age, I look at my parents and all my relatives of that era, that they all went through World War II, which was an incredible time of sacrifice, an incredible time of great demand on this country, of people having to, like, and not knowing that, you know, what would happen. I mean, we if you think about it, we lost something like over 20,000 people just at Iwo Jima, just one battle, you know, where 20,000 young Americans were killed. So I'm saying this country's been through some terrible times, and different generations have had to face terrible things. And they got through it, and afterwards, they did it by pulling together and doing what they needed to do, and then going on from there, and became even better and stronger. So in a way, those you know, it's been thrown around that this is like wartime, and kind of it is. You know, we are at war with this virus. And all I can say is we're all in this together, as everyone knows. And so just as we ultimately not only triumphed in World War II, but made the world a better place because of it, because we took the lead. I think it's time for America to kind of try to do that again, like step up. And, you know, we faltered a little bit early on, but now we just got to kind of pull it all together and say, okay, this is the way we do things here. This is the way it's going to get done. We're all going to get through this. You know, this whole country has been such a great experiment anyway. And we just have to show that this is the way, you know, this is the way we're going to go forward, and we're going to get through this adversity. That's all you can do.
Joe, Matt and I certainly appreciate your time. This was not only totally enjoyable, but it was so much fun to have you on and to talk about this. We didn't even get into much of your fabulous career, but hopefully sometime down the road we can do it again. Give.specialolympics.org, something that Joe and I would hope that you can find in your heart to give to this Special Olympics thing that is not obviously going to be delayed this year, just like all of our other events, but it's such an important one. And again, we can't thank you enough, Joe, and it's great talking to you. Have a safe and healthy year ahead, and hopefully we'll talk to you down the line soon.
That'd be great. Always fun to talk to the hometown. Take care, you guys.
Take care.
Thanks, Joe. Montaigne. Stay safe and stay sane. It's a good dude right there, huh?
Yeah, and you know what? That was great. We could have talked to him for 2 hours easily, and it would have been a lot of fun. But, you know, certainly entertaining to talk to Joe Montaigne. We have to take a break probably in a minute or two. But your thoughts on the interview?
Yeah, no, I enjoyed it thoroughly, and we could dissect a whole bunch of different parts of his career. I want Simpsons stories. I mean, he's Fat Tony from The Simpsons, he insists that every time Fat Tony appears, that he voices it, and he'll show up. He's like, he said, if Fat Tony belches, he wants to be the guy who belches. You know, he just loves being a part of it so much.